genetically manipulated mice, the presence or absence of the receptor gene influences aggression in females, depending on how many brothers there were in the litter in utero. Gene environment again. Once again, the magnitude of these genetic influences is tiny. Finally, there is work on genes related to glucocorticoids, particularly regarding gene-environment interactions. For example, there is an interaction between one variant of the gene for a type of receptor for glucocorticoids, for mavens it's the MR receptor, and childhood abuse in producing an amygdala that is hyperreactive to threat. Then there is a protein called FKBP5, which modifies the activity of another type of receptor for glucocorticoids, the GR receptor. One FKBP5 variant is associated with aggression, hostility, PTSD, and hyperreactivity of the amygdala to threat, but only when coupled with childhood abuse. Buoyed by these findings, some researchers have examined two candidate genes simultaneously. For example, having both risk variants of 5-HTT and DRD4 synergistically increases the risk of disruptive behavior in kids, an effect exacerbated by low socioeconomic status. Whew! All these pages, and we've only gotten to thinking about two genes and one environmental variable simultaneously. And despite this, things still aren't great. The usual. Results aren't terribly consistent from one study to the next. The usual. Effect sizes are small. Knowing what variant of a candidate gene someone has, or even what variants of a collection of genes, doesn't help much in predicting their behavior. A major reason is that, after getting a handle on 5-HTT and DRD4 interactions, there are still roughly 19,998 more human genes and a gazillion more environments to study. Time to switch to the other main approach. Looking at all those 20,000 genes at once. Fishing expeditions, instead of looking where the light is. The small effect sizes reflect a limitation in the candidate gene approach. In scientific lingo, the problem is that one is only looking where the light is. The cliche harks back to a joke. You discover someone at night searching the ground under a street lamp. What's wrong? I dropped my ring. I'm looking for it. Trying to be helpful, you ask, were you standing on this side or that side of the lamp when you dropped it? Oh no, I was over by those trees when I dropped it. Then why are you searching here? This is where the light is. With candidate gene approaches, you only look where the light is, examine only genes that you already know are involved. And with 20,000 or so genes, it's pretty safe to assume there are still some interesting genes that you don't know about yet. The challenge is to find them. The most common way of trying to find them all is with genome-wide association studies, GWAS. Examine, say, the gene for hemoglobin and look at the 11th nucleotide in the sequence. Everyone will pretty much have the same DNA letter in that spot. However, there are little hotspots of variability. Single nucleotides where, say, two different DNA letters occur, each in about 50% of the population, and where this typically doesn't change the amino acid being specified because of DNA redundancy. There are more than a million of such SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, scattered throughout the genome, in stretches of DNA coding for genes, for promoters, for mysterious DNA junk. Collect DNA from a huge number of people and examine whether particular SNPs associate with particular traits. If an SNP that's implicated occurs in a gene, you've just gotten a hint that the gene may be involved in that trait. Footnote. And, following that logic, if a trait associates with a particular version of an SNP in the promoter of a gene, you've just gotten a hint that the regulation of the gene, as opposed to the gene itself, may be involved in that trait. As an example, the gene for one type of serotonin receptor contains an SNP in the third base of the codon coding for the 34th amino acid in the protein, and one of the variants of that SNP is associated with responsiveness to a particular drug in schizophrenics. A GWAS study might implicate scads of genes as being associated with a trait. Hopefully, some will be candidate genes already known to be related to the trait. But other identified genes may be mysterious. Now, go check out what they do. In a related approach, suppose you have two populations, one with and one without a degenerative muscle disease. Take a muscle biopsy from everyone and see which of the roughly 20,000 genes are transcriptionally active in the muscle cells. With this microarray or gene chip approach, you look for genes that are transcriptionally active only in diseased or in healthy muscle, not in both. Identify them, and you have some new candidate genes to explore. These fishing expeditions show why we're so ignorant about the genetics of behavior. Consider a classic GWAS that looked for genes related to height. This was a crazy difficult study involving examining the genomes of 183,727 people. 183,727. It must have taken an army of scientists just to label the test tubes. And reflecting that, the paper reporting the findings in Nature had approximately 280 authors. And the results? Hundreds of genetic variants were implicated in regulating height. A handful of genes identified were known to be involved in skeletal growth, but the rest was terra incognita. The single genetic variant identified that most powerfully predicted height explained all of 0.4%, 0.4% of the variation in height, and all those hundreds of variants put together explained only about 10% of the variation. Meanwhile, an equally acclaimed study did a GWAS regarding body mass index, BMI. Similar amazingness. Almost 250,000 genomes examined, even more authors than the height study. And in this case, the single most explanatory genetic variant identified accounted for only 0.3% of the variation in BMI. Thus, both height and BMI are highly polygenic traits. Same for age of menarche, when girls menstruate for the first time. Moreover, additional genes are being missed because their variants are too rare to be picked up by current GWAS techniques. Thus, these traits are probably influenced by hundreds of genes. What about behavior? A superb 2013 GWAS study examined the genetic variants associated with educational attainment. The usual over-the-top numbers, 126,559 study subjects, about 180 authors. And the most predictive genetic variant accounted for 0.02%, 0.02% of the variation. All the identified variants together accounted for about 2% of the variation. A commentary accompanying the paper contained this landmark of understatement. In short, educational attainment looks to be a very polygenic trait. Educational attainment, how many years of high school or college one completes, is relatively easy to measure. How about the subtler, messier behaviors that fill this book's pages? A handful of studies have tackled that, and the findings are much the same. At the end, you have a list of scores of genes implicated and can then go figure out what they do, logically starting with the ones that showed the strongest statistical associations. Hard, hard approaches that are still in their infancy. Made worse by a GWAS missing more subtly variable spots, meaning even more genes are likely involved. As we conclude this section, some key points. A. This review of candidate genes barely scratches even the surface of the surface. Go on PubMed, a major search engine of the biomedical literature, and search MAO gene /behavior, up come more than 500 research papers. Serotonin transporter gene /behavior, 1,250 papers. Dopamine receptor gene /behavior, nearly 2,000. B. The candidate gene approaches show that the effect of a single gene on a behavior is typically tiny. In other words, Having the warrior gene variant of MAO probably has less effect on your behavior than does believing that you have it. C. Genome-wide survey approaches show that these behaviors are influenced by huge numbers of genes, each one playing only a tiny role. D. What this translates into is non-specificity. For example, serotonin transporter gene variants have been linked to risk of depression, but also anxiety, obsessive-compulsive disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, Tourette's syndrome, and borderline personality disorder. In other words, that gene is part of a network of hundreds of genes pertinent to depression, but also part of another equally large and partially overlapping network relevant to anxiety, another relevant to OCD, and so on. And meanwhile, we're plugging away, trying to understand interactions of two genes at a time. E. And, of course, gene and environment, gene and environment. Conclusions. At long last, you and I have gotten to the end of this excruciatingly but necessarily long chapter. Amid all these tiny effects and technical limitations, it's important to not throw out the genetic baby with the bathwater, as has been an agitated sociopolitical goal at times, during my intellectual youth in the 1970s, sandwiched between the geologic periods of cranberry bell-bottoms and of John Travolta white suits, was the genes have nothing to do with behavior ice age. Genes have plenty to do with behavior. Even more appropriately, all behavioral traits are affected to some degree by genetic variability. They have to be, given that they specify the structure of all the proteins pertinent to every neurotransmitter, hormone, receptor, etc., that there is. And they have plenty to do with individual differences in behavior, given the large percentage of genes that are polymorphic, coming in different flavors. But their effects are supremely context-dependent. Ask not what a gene does. Ask what it does in a particular environment and when expressed in a particular network of other genes, i.e. gene/gene/gene/gene/environment. Thus, for our purposes, genes aren't about inevitability. Instead, they're about context-dependent tendencies, propensities, potentials, and vulnerabilities, all embedded in the fabric of the other factors, biological and otherwise, that fill these pages. Now that this chapter's done, why don't we all take a bathroom break and then see what's in the refrigerator? Chapter 9. Centuries to Millennia Before. Let's start with a seeming digression. Parts of chapters 4 and 7 have debunked some supposed sex differences concerning the brain, hormones, and behavior. One difference, however, is persistent. It's far from issues that concern this book, but bear with me. A remarkably consistent finding, starting with elementary school students, is that males are better at math than females. While the difference is minor when it comes to considering average scores, there is a huge difference when it comes to math stars at the upper extreme of the distribution. For example, in 1983, for every girl scoring in the highest percentile on the math SAT, there were 11 boys. Why the difference? There have always been suggestions that testosterone is central. During development, testosterone fuels the growth of a brain region involved in mathematical thinking, and giving adults testosterone enhances some math skills. Oh, okay, it's biological. But consider a paper published in Science in 2008. The authors examined the relationship between math scores and sexual equality in 40 countries based on economic, educational, and political indices of gender equality. The worst was Turkey, the United States was middling, and naturally, the Scandinavians were tops. Lo and behold, the more gender equal the country, the less of a discrepancy in math scores. By the time you get to the Scandinavian countries, it's statistically insignificant. And by the time you examine the most gender-equal country on Earth at the time, Iceland, girls are better at math than boys. Footnote. Note that the other reliable sex difference in cognition, namely better reading performance by girls than by boys, doesn't disappear in more gender-equal societies. It gets bigger. In other words, culture matters. We carry it with us wherever we go. As one example, the level of corruption, the government's lack of transparency regarding use of power and finances in UN diplomats' home countries, predicts their likelihood of racking up unpaid parking tickets in Manhattan. Culture leaves long-lasting residues. Shiites and Sunnis slaughter each other over a succession issue 14 centuries old. Across 33 countries, population density in the year 1500 significantly predicts how authoritarian the government was in 2000. Over the course of millennia, earlier adoption of the hoe over the plow predicts gender equality today. And in other words, when we contemplate our iconic acts, the pulling of a trigger, the touching of an arm, and want to explain why they happened using a biological framework, culture better be on our list of explanatory factors. Thus, the goals of this chapter. Look at systematic patterns of cultural variation as they pertain to the best and worst of our behaviors. Explore how different types of brains produce different culture, and different types of culture produce different brains. In other words, how culture and biology co-evolve. See the role of ecology in shaping culture. Definitions, similarities, and differences. Culture, naturally, has been defined various ways. One influential definition comes from Edward Tyler, a distinguished 19th-century cultural anthropologist. For him, culture is that complex whole which includes knowledge, belief, art, morals, law, custom, and any other capabilities and habits acquired by man as a member of society. This definition, obviously, is oriented towards something that is specific to humans. Jane Goodall blew off everyone's socks in the 1960s by reporting the now iconic fact that chimps make tools. Her study subjects modified twigs by stripping off the leaves and pushing them into termite mounds. Termites would bite the twig, still holding on when it was pulled out, yielding a snack for the chimps. This was just the start. Chimps were subsequently found to use various tools, wood or rock anvils for cracking open nuts, wads of chewed leaves to sponge up hard-to-reach water, and, in a real shocker, sharpened sticks for spearing bush babies. Different populations make different tools. New techniques spread across social networks among chimps who hang with one another. Kids learn the ropes by watching their moms. Techniques spread from one group to another when someone emigrates. Chimp nutcracking tools in excess of 4,000 years old have been excavated. And in my favorite example, floating between tool use and accessorizing, a female in Zambia got it into her head to go around with a straw-like blade of grass in her ear. The action had no obvious function. Apparently, she just liked having a piece of grass sticking out of her ear. So sue her. She did it for years, and over that time, the practice spread throughout her group, a fashionista. In the decades since Goodall's discovery, tool use has been observed in apes and monkeys, elephants, sea otters, mongoose. Dolphins use sea sponges to dig up fish burrowed into the sea floor. Birds use tools for nest building or food acquisition. Jays and crows, for example, use twigs to fish for insects, much as chimps do. And there's tool use in cephalopods, reptiles, and fish. All this is mighty impressive. Nonetheless, such cultural transmission doesn't show progression. This year's chimp nutcracking tool is pretty much the same as that of 4,000 years ago. And with few exceptions, more later, non-human culture is solely about material culture versus, say, social organization. So the classical definition of culture isn't specific to humans. Most cultural anthropologists weren't thrilled with Goodall's revolution. Great, next the zoologists will report that Rafiki persuaded Simba to become the Lion King. And now often emphasize definitions of culture that cut chimps and other hoi polloi out of the party. There's a fondness for the thinking of Alfred Kroeber, Clyde Cluckhone, and Clifford Geertz, three heavyweight social anthropologists who focused on how culture is about ideas and symbols rather than the mere behaviors in which they instantiate, or material products like flint blades or iPhones. Contemporary anthropologists like Richard Schwader have emphasized a more effective but still human-centric view of culture as being about moral and visceral versions of right and wrong. And of course, these views have been critiqued by postmodernists for reasons I can't begin to follow. Basically, I don't want to go anywhere near these debates. For our purposes, we'll rely on an intuitive definition of culture that has been emphasized by Franz de Waal. Culture is how we do and think about things, transmitted by non-genetic means. Working with that broad definition, is the most striking thing about the array of human cultures the similarities or the differences? Depends on your taste. If the similarities seem most interesting, there are plenty. After all, multiple groups of humans independently invented agriculture, writing, pottery, embalming, astronomy, and coinage. At the extreme of similarities are human universals, and numerous scholars have proposed lists of them. One of the lengthiest and most cited comes from the anthropologist Donald Brown. Here's a partial list of his proposed cultural universals. The existence of and concern with aesthetics, magic, males and females seen as having different natures, baby talk, gods, induction of altered states, marriage, body adornment, murder, prohibition of some type of murder, kinship terms, numbers, cooking, private sex, names, dance, play, distinctions between right and wrong, nepotism, prohibitions on certain types of sex, empathy, reciprocity, rituals, concepts of fairness, myths about afterlife, music, color terms, prohibitions, gossip, binary sex terms, in-group favoritism, language, humor, lying, symbolism, the linguistic concept of and, tools, trade, and toilet training. And that's a partial list. For the purposes of this chapter, the staggeringly large cultural differences in how life is experienced, in resources and privileges available, in opportunities and trajectories, are most interesting. Just to start with some breathtaking demographic statistics born of cultural differences. A girl born in Monaco has a 93-year life expectancy. One in Angola, 39. Latvia has 99.9% literacy. Niger, 19%. More than 10% of children in Afghanistan die in their first year, about 0.2% in Iceland. Per capita GDP is $137,000 in Qatar, $609 in the Central African Republic. A woman in South Sudan is roughly 1,000 times more likely to die in childbirth than a woman in Estonia. The experience of violence also varies enormously by culture. Someone in Honduras is 450 times more likely to be murdered than someone in Singapore. 65% of women experience intimate partner violence in Central Africa, 16% in East Asia. A South African woman is more than 100 times more likely to be raped than one in Japan. Be a school kid in Romania, Bulgaria, or Ukraine, and you're about 10 times more likely to be chronically bullied than a kid in Sweden, Iceland, or Denmark. Stay tuned for a closer look at this. Of course, there are the well-known gender-related cultural differences. There are the Scandinavian countries approaching total gender equality and Rwanda, with 63% of its lower house parliamentary seats filled by women, compared with Saudi Arabia, where women are not allowed outside the house unless accompanied by male guardian, and Yemen, Qatar, and Tonga, with 0% female legislators, and with the United States running around 20%. Then there's the Philippines, where 93% of people say they feel happy and loved, versus 29% of Armenians. In economic games, people in Greece and Oman are more likely to spend resources to punish overly generous players than to punish those who are cheaters, whereas among Australians, such antisocial punishment is non-existent. And there are wildly different criteria for pro-social behavior. In a study of employees throughout the world working for the same multinational bank, what was the most important reason cited to help someone? Among Americans, it was that the person had previously helped them. For Chinese, it was that the person was higher ranking. In Spain, that they were a friend or acquaintance. Your life will be unrecognizably different, depending on which culture the stork deposited you into. In wading through this variability, there are some pertinent patterns, contrasts, and dichotomies. Collectivist versus individualist cultures. As introduced in Chapter 7, a large percentage of cross-cultural psychology studies compare collectivist with individualist cultures. This almost always means comparisons between subjects from collectivist East Asian cultures and Americans, coming from that mother of all individualist cultures. As defined, collectivist cultures are about harmony, interdependence, conformity, and having the needs of the group guiding behavior, whereas individualist cultures are about autonomy, personal achievement, uniqueness, and the needs and rights of the individual. Just to be a wee bit caustic, individualist culture can be summarized by that classic American concept of looking out for number one. Collectivist culture can be summarized by the archetypical experience of American Peace Corps teachers in such countries. Pose your students a math question, and no one will volunteer the correct answer because they don't want to stand out and shame their classmates. Individualist/collectivist contrasts are striking. In individualist cultures, people more frequently seek uniqueness and personal accomplishment, use first-person singular pronouns more often, define themselves in terms that are personal, I'm a contractor, rather than relational, I'm a parent, attribute their success to intrinsic attributes, I'm really good at X, rather than to situational ones, I was in the right place at the right time. The past is more likely to be remembered via events. That's the summer I learned to swim, rather than social interactions. That's the summer we became friends. Motivation and satisfaction are gained from self rather than group-derived effort, reflecting the extent to which American individualism is about non-cooperation rather than non-conformity. Competitive drive is about getting ahead of everyone else. When asked to draw a sociogram, a diagram of their social network, with circles representing themselves and their friends connected by lines, Americans tend to place the circle representing themselves in the middle of the page and make it the largest. In contrast, those from collectivist cultures show more social comprehension. Some reports suggest that they are better at theory of mind tasks, more accurate in understanding someone else's perspective, with perspective ranging from the other person's abstract thoughts to how objects appear from where she is sitting. There is more blame of the group when someone violates a norm due to peer pressure, and a greater tendency to give situational explanations for behavior. Competitive drive is about not falling behind everyone else. And when drawing sociograms, the circle representing yourself is far from the center and far from the biggest. Naturally, these cultural differences have biological correlates. For example, subjects from individualist cultures strongly activate the emotional MPFC when looking at a picture of themselves compared to looking at a picture of a relative or friend. In contrast, the activation is far less for East Asian subjects. Footnote: these are tough studies to pull off, as neuroimaging is a bit of an art in addition to a science, and being able to quantitatively compare data derived from two scanners and scanning protocols on opposite sides of the globe is challenging. The alternative, having subjects from both cultures studied in the same scanner, is challenging as well. Those aren't going to be representative subjects, since half of them are probably international students, connected, well-off, and adventurous enough to be in an American college town volunteering for a Psych 101 study. Another example is a favorite demonstration of mine of cross-cultural differences in psychological stress. When asked in free recall, Americans are more likely than East Asians to remember times in which they influenced someone. Conversely, East Asians are more likely to remember times when someone influenced them. Force Americans to talk at length about a time someone influenced them, or force East Asians to detail their influencing someone, and both secrete glucocorticoids from the stressfulness of having to recount this discomforting event. And work by my Stanford colleagues and friends, Jeannie Tsai and Brian Knudsen, shows that mesolimbic dopamine systems activate in European Americans when looking at excited facial expressions, in Chinese, when looking at calm expressions. As we will see in Chapter 13, these cultural differences produce different moral systems. In the most traditional of collectivist societies, conformity and morality are virtually synonymous, and norm enforcement is more about shame. What will people think if I did that? Then guilt. How could I live with myself? Collectivist cultures foster more utilitarian and consequentialist moral stances. For example, a greater willingness for an innocent person to be jailed in order to prevent a riot. The tremendous collectivist emphasis on the group produces a greater degree of in-group bias than among individualist culture members. In one study, for example, Korean and European American subjects observed pictures of either in- or out-group members in pain. All subjects reported more subjective empathy and showed more activation of theory of mind brain regions, i.e. the temporoparietal junction, when observing in-group members, but the bias was significantly greater among Korean subjects. In addition, subjects from both individualist and collectivist cultures denigrate out-group members, but only the former inflate assessments of their own group. In other words, East Asians, unlike Americans, don't have to puff up their own group to view others as inferior. What is fascinating is the direction that some of these differences take, as shown in approaches pioneered by one of the giants in this field, Richard Nisbet of the University of Michigan. Westerners problem solve in a more linear fashion, with more reliance on linguistic rather than spatial coding. When asked to explain the movement of a ball, East Asians are more likely to invoke relational explanations built around the interactions of the ball with its environment, friction, while Westerners focus on intrinsic properties like weight and density. Westerners are more accurate at estimating length in absolute terms. How long is that line? While East Asians are better with relational estimates. How much longer is this line than that? Or how's this one? Consider a monkey, a bear, and a banana. Which two go together? Westerners think categorically and choose the monkey and bear. They're both animals. East Asians think relationally and link the monkey and banana. If you're thinking of a monkey, also think of food it will need. Remarkably, the cultural differences extend to sensory processing, where Westerners process information in a more focused manner, East Asians in a more holistic one. Show a picture of a person standing in the middle of a complex scene. East Asians will be more accurate at remembering the scene, the context, while Westerners remember the person in the middle. Remarkably, this is even observed on the level of eye tracking. Typically, Westerners' eyes first look at a picture's center, while East Asians scan the overall scene. Moreover, force Westerners to focus on the holistic context of a picture, or East Asians on the central subject, and the frontal cortex works harder, activating more. As covered in Chapter 7, cultural values are first inculcated early in life, so it's no surprise that culture shapes our attitudes about success, morality, happiness, love, and so on. But what is startling to me is how these cultural differences also shape where your eye focuses on a picture, or how you think about monkeys and bananas, or the physics of a ball's trajectory. Culture's impact is enormous. Naturally, there are various caveats concerning collectivist/individualist comparisons. The most obvious is the perpetual on the average. There are plenty of Westerners, for example, who are more collectivist than plenty of East Asians. In general, people who are most individualist by various personality measures are most individualist in neuroimaging studies. Cultures change over time. For example, levels of conformity in East Asian cultures are declining. One study, for example, shows increased rates of babies in Japan receiving unique names. Moreover, one's degree of inculcation into one's culture can be altered rapidly. For example, priming someone beforehand with individualist or collectivist cultural cues shifts how holistically he processes a picture. This is especially true for bicultural individuals. We will soon see about some genetic differences between collectivist and individualist populations. There is nothing resembling genetic destiny about this. The best evidence for this conclusion comes from one of the control groups in many of these studies, namely East Asian Americans. In general, it takes about a generation for the descendants of East Asian immigrants to America to be as individualist as European Americans. Obviously, East Asians and Westerners are not monolithic entities. Just ask someone from Beijing versus the Tibetan steppes. Or stick three people from Berkeley, Brooklyn, and Biloxi in a stalled elevator for a few hours and see what happens. As we will see, there is striking variation within cultures. Why should people in one part of the globe have developed collectivist cultures while others went individualist? The United States is the individualism poster child for at least two reasons. First, there's immigration. Currently, 12% of Americans are immigrants. Another 12% are, like me, children of immigrants. And everyone else, except for the 0.9% pure Native Americans, descend from people who emigrated within the last 500 years. And who were the immigrants? Those in the settled world who were cranks, malcontents, restless, heretical, black sheep, hyperactive, hypomanic, misanthropic, itchy, unconventional, yearning to be free, yearning to be rich, yearning to be out of their damn boring, repressive little hamlet, yearning. Couple that with a second reason. For the majority of its colonial and independent history, America has had a moving frontier, luring those whose extremely prickly optimism made merely booking passage to the New World insufficiently novel. And you've got America, the individualistic. Why has East Asia provided textbook examples of collectivism? The key is how culture is shaped by the way people traditionally made a living, which in turn is shaped by ecology. And in East Asia, it's all about rice. Rice, which was domesticated there roughly 10,000 years ago, requires massive amounts of communal work. Not just backbreaking planting and harvesting, which are done in rotation because the entire village is needed to harvest each family's rice. Collective labor is first needed to transform the ecosystem, terracing mountains and building and maintaining irrigation systems for controlled flooding of paddies. And there's the issue of dividing up water fairly. In Bali, religious authority regulates water access, symbolized by iconic water temples. How's this for amazing? The Dujianyin irrigation system irrigates more than 5,000 square kilometers of rice farms near Chengdu, China. And it is more than 2,000 years old. The roots of collectivism, like those of rice, run deep in East Asia. A fascinating 2014 science paper strengthens the rice-slash-collectivism connection by exploring an exception. In parts of northern China, it's difficult to grow rice, and instead, people have grown wheat for millennia. This involves individual rather than collective farming. And by the standard tests of individualist versus collectivist cultures, e.g. draw sociogram, which two are most similar of a rabbit, dog, and carrot, they look like Westerners. The region has two other markers of individualism, namely higher rates of divorce and of inventiveness, patent filings, than in rice-growing regions. The roots of individualism, like those of wheat, run deep in northern China. The links between ecology, mode of production, and culture are shown in a rare collectivist/individualist study not comparing Asians and Westerners. The author studied a Turkish region on the Black Sea, where mountains hug the coastline. There, in close proximity, people live by fishing, by farming the narrow ribbon of land between the sea and the mountains, or as mountain shepherds. All three groups had the same language, religion, and gene stock. Herding is solitary. While Turkish farmers and fishermen, and women, were no Chinese rice farmers, they at least worked their fields in groups and manned their fishing boats and crews. Herders thought less holistically than farmers or fishermen. The former were better at judging absolute length of lines, the other two at relative judgments. When shown a glove, a scarf, and a hand, herders grouped gloves and scarves categorically, while the others grouped relationally, pairing gloves and hands. In the author's words, social interdependence fosters holistic thinking. This theme appears in another study, comparing Jewish boys from either observant Orthodox homes, dominated by endless shared rules about beliefs and behaviors, with ones from far more individualist secular homes. Visual processing was more holistic in the Orthodox, more focused in the secular. The East Asian slash Western collectivist slash individualist dichotomy has a fascinating genetic correlate. Recall from the last chapter dopamine and DRD4, the gene for the D4 receptor. It's extraordinarily variable, with at least 25 human variants, with lesser variability in other primates. Moreover, the variation isn't random, inconsequential drift of DNA sequences. Instead, there has been strong positive selection for variants. Most common is the 4R variant, occurring in about half of East Asians and European Americans. There's also the 7R variant, producing a receptor less responsive to dopamine in the cortex, associated with novelty-seeking, extroversion, and impulsivity. It predates modern humans, but became dramatically more common 10 to 20,000 years ago. The 7R variant occurs in about 23% of Europeans and European Americans, and in East Asians, 1%. So which came first, 7R frequency or cultural style? The 4R and 7R variants, along with the 2R, occur worldwide, implying they already existed when humans radiated out of Africa 60,000 to 130,000 years ago. Classic work by Kenneth Kidd of Yale examining the distribution of 7R shows something remarkable. There's roughly a 10 to 25% incidence of 7R in various African, European, and Middle Eastern populations. There's a slightly higher incidence among the descendants of those who started island hopping from mainland Asia to Malaysia and New Guinea. The same for folks whose ancestors migrated to North America via the Bering Land Bridge about 15,000 years ago. The Muskoki, Cheyenne, and Pima tribes of Native Americans. Then the Maya in Central America, up to around 40%. Then the Guahiba and Quechua of the northern parts of South America at around 55%. Finally, there are the descendants of folks who made it all the way to the Amazon basin, the Ticuna, Surui, and Caritiana, with a roughly 70% incidence of 7R, the highest in the world. In other words, the descendants of people who, having made it to the future downtown Anchorage, decided to just keep going for another 6,000 miles. A high incidence of 7R, associated with impulsivity and novelty-seeking, is the legacy of humans who made the greatest migrations in human history. And then in the middle is the near zero incidence of 7R in China, Cambodia, Japan, and Taiwan among the Ami and Atayal. When East Asians domesticated rice and invented collectivist society, there was massive selection against the 7R variant. In kids' words, it was nearly lost in these populations. Maybe the bearers of 7R broke their necks inventing hang gliding, or got antsy and tried to walk to Alaska, but drowned because there was no longer a Bering land bridge. Maybe they were less desirable mates. Regardless of the cause, East Asian cultural collectivism co-evolved with selection against the 7R variant. Thus, in this most studied of cultural contrasts, we see clustering of ecological factors, modes of production, cultural differences, and differences in endocrinology, neurobiology, and gene frequencies. The cultural contrasts appear in likely ways, e.g. morality, empathy, child-rearing practices, competition, cooperation, definitions of happiness, but also in unexpected ones, e.g. where Within milliseconds, your eyes look at a picture, or you're thinking about bunnies and carrots. Pastoralists and Southerners. Another important link among ecology, mode of production, and culture is seen in dry, hard-scrabble, wide-open environments too tough for agriculture. This is the world of nomadic pastoralism, people wandering the desert, steppes, or tundra with their herds. There are Bedouins in Arabia, Tuareg in North Africa, Somalis and Maasai in East Africa, Sami of northern Scandinavia, Gujars in India, Yurok in Turkey, Tuvans of Mongolia, Aymara in the Andes. There are herds of sheep, goats, cows, llamas, camels, yaks, horses, or reindeer, with the pastoralists living off their animals' meat, milk, and blood, and trading their wool and hides. Anthropologists have long noted similarities in pastoralist cultures, born of their tough environments and the typically minimal impact of centralized government and the rule of law. In that isolated toughness stands a central fact of pastoralism. Thieves can't steal the crops on someone's farm or the hundreds of edible plants eaten by hunter-gatherers, but they can steal someone's herd. This is the vulnerability of pastoralism, a world of rustlers and raiders. This generates various correlates of pastoralism. Militarism abounds. Pastoralists, particularly in deserts, with their far-flung members tending the herds, are a spawning ground for warrior classes. And with them typically come A. military trophies as stepping stones to societal status, B. death in battle as a guarantee of a glorious afterlife, C. high rates of economic polygamy and mistreatment of women, and D. authoritarian parenting. It is rare for pastoralists to be pastoral, in the sense of Beethoven's Sixth Symphony. Worldwide, monotheism is relatively rare. To the extent that it does occur, it is disproportionately likely among desert pastoralists, while rainforest dwellers are atypically likely to be polytheistic. This makes sense. Deserts teach tough, singular things, a world reduced to simple, desiccated, furnace-blasted basics that are approached with a deep fatalism. I am the Lord your God, and there is but one God, and his name is Allah, and there will be no gods before me, dictates like these proliferate. As implied in the final quote, desert monotheism does not always come with only one supernatural being. Monotheistic religions are replete with angels and jinns and devils. But they sure come with a hierarchy, minor deities paling before the omnipotent one, who tends to be highly interventionist both in the heavens and on earth. In contrast, think of tropical rainforest, teeming with life, where you can find more species of ants on a single tree than in all of Britain. Letting 100 deities bloom in equilibrium must seem the most natural thing in the world. Pastoralism fosters cultures of honor. As introduced in Chapter 7, these are about rules of civility, courtesy, and hospitality, especially to the weary traveler, because, after all, aren't all herders often weary travelers? Even more so, cultures of honor are about taking retribution after affronts to self, family, or clan, and reputational consequences for failing to do so. If they take your camel today and you do nothing, tomorrow they will take the rest of your herd, plus your wives and daughters. Footnote. I once got to experience what this looks like for an extended stretch as I traveled with a group of Somalis who were driving empty gasoline tankers back from Sudan to the Indian Ocean in Kenya for refilling. At the end of each day of driving through the desert, we'd sit around a campfire between the trucks, cooking a pot of spaghetti and camel's milk. Why that particular combo? That's a whole other story. And inevitably, one of the six Somalis would do something that was perceived as insulting by someone. There would be snarling, angry words, knives drawn from boots, two guys circling and lunging at each other, until everyone else roused themselves to get the two to settle down. And then, the hospitality flip side of the culture on display. Everyone would hurry over to make sure I got the best of the spaghetti-slash-milk glob. "Eat, eat, you are our brother," they'd say, including whichever two had just been slashing at each other. Few of humanity's low or high points are due to the culturally based actions of, say, Sami wandering the north of Finland with their reindeer, or Maasai cowherders in the Serengeti. Instead, the most pertinent cultures of honor are ones in more westernized settings. Culture of honor has been used to describe the workings of the mafia in Sicily, the patterns of violence in rural 19th century Ireland, and the causes and consequences of retributive killings by inner-city gangs. All occur in circumstances of resource competition, including the singular resource of being the last side to do a retributive killing in a vendetta, of a power vacuum provided by the minimal presence of the rule of law, and where prestige is ruinously lost if challenges are left unanswered, and where the answer is typically a violent one. Amid those, the most famous example of a westernized culture of honor is the American South, the subject of books, academic journals, conferences, and Southern studies majors in universities. Much of this work was pioneered by Nisbet. Hospitality, chivalry toward women, and emphasis on social decorum and etiquette are long associated with the South. In addition, the South traditionally emphasizes legacy, long cultural memory, and continuity of family. In rural Kentucky in the 1940s, for example, 70% of men had the same first name as their father, far more than in the North. When coupled with lesser mobility in the South, honor in need of defense readily extends to family, clan, and place. For example, by the time the Hatfields and McCoys famously began their nearly 30-year feud in 1863, they had lived in the same region of the West Virginia/Kentucky border for nearly a century. The Southern sense of honor in place is also seen in Robert E. Lee. He opposed Southern secession, even made some ambiguous statements that could be viewed as opposed to slavery. Yet when offered the command of the Union Army by Lincoln, Lee wrote, "I wish to live under no other government, and there is no sacrifice I'm not ready to make for the preservation of the Union, save that of honor." When Virginia chose secession, he regretfully fulfilled his sense of honor to his home and led the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia. In the South, defense of honor was, above all, an act of self-reliance. The Southerner Andrew Jackson was advised by his dying mother to never seek redress from the law for any grievances, to instead be a man and take things into his own hands. That he certainly did, with a history of dueling, even fatally, and brawling. On his final day as president, he articulated two regrets in leaving office, that he had been unable to shoot Henry Clay or to hang John C. Calhoun. Carrying out justice personally was viewed as a requirement in the absence of a functional legal system. At best, legal justice and individual justice were in uneasy equilibrium in the 19th century South. In the words of the Southern historian Bertram Wyatt Brown, common law and lynch law were ethically compatible. The first enabled the legal profession to present traditional order, and the second conferred upon ordinary men the prerogative of ensuring that community values held ultimate sovereignty. The core of retribution for honor violations was, of course, violence. Sticks and stones might break your bones, but names will cause you to break the offender's bones. Dueling was commonplace, the point being not that you were willing to kill, but that you were willing to die for your honor. Many a Confederate boy went off to war, advised by his mother that better he come back in a coffin than as a coward who fled. The result of this all is a long, still extant history of high rates of violence in the South. But crucially, violence of a particular type. I once heard it summarized by a Southern studies scholar describing the weirdness of leaving the rural South to start grad school in a strange place, Cambridge, Massachusetts, where families would get together at 4th of July picnics and no one would shoot each other. Nisbet and Dove Cohen have shown that the high rates of violence, particularly of murder, by white Southern males, are not features of large cities or about attempts to gain material goods. We're not talking liquor store stick-ups. Instead, the violence is disproportionately rural, among people who know each other, and concerns slights to honor. That sleazebag cousin thought it was okay to flirt with your wife at the family reunion, so you shot him. Moreover, Southern juries are atypically forgiving of such acts. Southern violence was explored in one of the all-time coolest psychology studies involving the use of a word rare in science journals, conducted by Nisbet and Cohen. Undergraduate male subjects had a blood sample taken. They then filled out a questionnaire about something and were then supposed to drop it off down the hall. It was in the narrow hallway, filled with file cabinets, that the experiment happened. Half the subjects traversed the corridor uneventfully. But with half, a Confederate, get it, ha-ha, of the psychologists, a big beefy guy, approached from the opposite direction. As the subject and the plant squeezed by each other, the latter would jostle the subject and, in an irritated voice, say the magic word, asshole, and march on. Subject would continue down the hall to drop off the questionnaire. What was the response to this insult? It depended. Subjects from the South, but not from elsewhere, showed massive increases in levels of testosterone and glucocorticoids, anger, rage, stress. Subjects were then told a scenario where a guy observes a male acquaintance making a pass at his fiancée. What happens next in the story? In control subjects, Southerners were a bit more likely than Northerners to imagine a violent outcome. And after being insulted? No change in Northerners and a massive boost in imagined violence among Southerners. Where do these westernized cultures of honor come from? Violence between the Crips and the Bloods in L.A. is not readily traced to combatants' mindsets from growing up herding yak. Nonetheless, pastoralist roots have been suggested to explain the Southern culture of honor. The theory, as first propounded by historian David Hackett Fisher in 1989. Early American regionalism arose from colonists in different parts of America coming from different places. There were the Pilgrims from East Anglia in New England, Quakers from North Midlands going to Pennsylvania and Delaware, Southern English indentured servants to Virginia, and the rest of the South, disproportionately herders from Scotland, Ireland, and Northern England. Naturally, the idea has some problems. Pastoralists from the British Isles mostly settled in the hill country of the South, whereas the honor culture is stronger in the Southern lowlands. Others have suggested that the Southern ethos of retributive violence was born from the white Southern nightmare scenario of slave uprisings. But most historians have found a lot of validity in Fisher's idea. Violence turned inward. Culture of honor violence is not just about outside threat. The camel rustlers from the next tribe, the jerk at the roadhouse who came on to some guy's girlfriend. Instead, it is equally defined by its role when honor is threatened from within. Chapter 11 examines when norm violations by members of your own group provoke cover-ups, excuses, or leniency, and when they provoke severe public punishment. The latter is when you've dishonored us in front of everyone, a culture of honor specialty, which raises the issue of honor killings. What constitutes an honor killing? Someone does something considered to tarnish the reputation of the family. A family member then kills the despoiler, often publicly, thereby regaining face. Mind-boggling. Some characteristics of honor killings. While they have been widespread historically, contemporary ones are mostly restricted to traditional Muslim, Hindu, and Sikh communities. Victims are usually young women. Their most common crimes? Refusing an arranged marriage, seeking to divorce an abusive spouse and or a spouse to whom they were forcibly married as a child, seeking education, resisting constraining religious orthodoxy, such as covering their head, marrying, living with, dating, interacting with, or speaking to an unapproved male, infidelity, religious conversion. In other words, a woman resisting being the property of her male relatives. And also, stunningly, staggeringly, a frequent cause of honor killings is being raped. In the rare instances of men being subject to honor killings, the typical cause is homosexuality. There has been debate as to whether honor killings are just domestic violence and whether morbid Western fascination with them reflects anti-Muslim bias. If some Baptist guy in Alabama murders his wife because she wants a divorce, no one frames it as a Christian honor killing, reflecting deep religious barbarity. But honor killings typically differ from garden variety domestic violence in several ways. A, the latter is usually committed by a male partner. The former are usually committed by male blood relatives, often with the approval of and facilitation by female relatives. B, the former is rarely an act of spontaneous passion, but instead is often planned with the approval of family members. C. Honor killings are often rationalized on religious grounds, presented without remorse, and approved by religious leaders. D. Honor killings are carried out openly. After all, how else can honor be regained for the family? And the chosen perpetrator is often an underage relative, e.g. a younger brother, to minimize the extent of sentencing for the act. By some pretty meaningful criteria, this is not just domestic violence. According to estimates by the UN and advocacy groups, 5 to 20,000 honor killings occur annually, and they are not restricted to far-off alien lands. Instead, they occur throughout the West, where patriarchs expect their daughters to be untouched by the world they moved them to, where a daughter's successful assimilation into this world proclaims the irrelevance of that patriarch. Stratified versus egalitarian cultures. Another meaningful way to think about cross-cultural variation concerns how unequally resources, e.g. land, food, material goods, power, or prestige, are distributed. Hunter-gatherer societies have typically been egalitarian, as we'll soon see, throughout hominin history. Inequality emerged when stuff, things to possess and accumulate, was invented following animal domestication and the development of agriculture. The more stuff, reflecting surplus, job specialization, and technological sophistication, the greater the potential inequality. Moreover, inequality expands enormously when cultures invent inheritance within families. Once invented, inequality became pervasive. Among traditional pastoralist or small-scale agricultural societies, levels of wealth inequality match or exceed those in the most unequal industrialized societies. Why have stratified cultures dominated the planet, generally replacing more egalitarian ones? For population biologist Peter Turchin, the answer is that stratified cultures are ideally suited to being conquerors. They come with chains of command. Both empirical and theoretical work suggests that in addition, in unstable environments, stratified societies are better able to survive resource shortages than egalitarian cultures by sequestering mortality in the lower classes. In other words, when times are tough, the unequal access to wealth becomes the unequal distribution of misery and death. Notably, though, stratification is not the only solution to such instability. This is where hunter-gatherers benefit from being able to pick up and move. A score of millennia after the invention of inequality, westernized societies at the extremes of the inequality continuum differ strikingly. One difference concerns social capital. Economic capital is the collective quantity of goods, services, and financial resources. Social capital is the collective quantity of resources such as trust, reciprocity, and cooperation. You learn a ton about a community's social capital with two simple questions. First, can people usually be trusted? A community in which most people answer yes is one with fewer locks, with people watching out for one another's kids and intervening in situations where one could easily look away. The second question is how many organizations someone participates in, from the purely recreational, e.g. a bowling league, to the vital, e.g. unions, tenant groups, co-op banks. A community with high levels of such participation is one where people feel efficacious, where institutions work transparently enough that people believe they can effect change. People who feel helpless don't join organizations. Put simply, cultures with more income inequality have less social capital. Trust requires reciprocity, and reciprocity requires equality, whereas hierarchy is about domination and asymmetry. Moreover, a culture highly unequal in material resources is almost always also unequal in the ability to pull the strings of power, to have efficacy, to be visible. For example, as income inequality grows, the percentage of people who bother voting generally declines. Almost by definition, you can't have a society with both dramatic income inequality and plentiful social capital. Or translated from social science-ese, marked inequality makes people crummier to one another. This can be shown in various ways, studied on the levels of westernized countries, states, provinces, cities, and towns. The more income inequality, the less likely people are to help someone, in an experimental setting, and the less generous and cooperative they are in economic games. Early in the chapter, I discussed cross-cultural rates of bullying and of antisocial punishment, where people in economic games punish overly generous players more than they punish cheaters. Footnote. What's antisocial punishment about? The general interpretation is that people are being punished for being generous because they make everyone else look bad and increase the expectation of generosity from everyone else. Studies of these phenomena show that